did was put into place the right to a healthy environment guaranteed for current and future generations.
We have
the United Nations
then,
followed suit. And now the world has the opportunity to implement that right. And what Exxon really doesn't want is for us to regulate and hold them to account for all of their emissions, from the production to consumption of emissions. And that's their biggest fear with this case, is that that's what they're going to be held to. And we can all support Melinda in hoping that that outcome comes to pass.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. And, of course, we'll continue to follow this story. Investigative journalist Antonia Yuhas will link to your new Wired article, The Quest to Defuse Guyana's Carbon Bomb, and Melinda Janke, Guyanese environmental lawyer who has sued Exxon and Guyana. I'm Amy Goodman. Safe holiday.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Coming up this Monday at 2 p.m. on December 26th, Boxing Day, the Monday Sampler will present a special Christmas-themed adventure of the greatest detective in the world, Sherlock Holmes, narrated by his good friend, Dr. John Watson.
Holmes always called it the adventure of the Christmas bride. It concerns a ghostly lady in white who was supposed to have disappeared centuries ago. The honor of a noble family and a certain Father Christmas who suddenly sank base.
The game will have found its feet again this Monday as the Monday Sampler presents The Adventure of the Christmas Bride. With John Stanley as Sherlock Holmes and Alfred Shirley as Dr. John Watson. And we'll also have a lot of music. So tune in right here on Community Radio KBOO Portland for the Monday Sampler this Monday at 2 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, severe winter weather rocks the Pacific Northwest and throws a wrench into holiday travel. Congress passes a $1.7 trillion budget bill. And new EPA action to confront harmful spills in the Columbia River. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 23rd, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem. Icy conditions and a winter storm warning persist in the Pacific Northwest and are expected to last until Saturday. Portland General Electric says there are 98 active power outages in the Portland metro area this afternoon, impacting over 5,000 homes. PGE says high winds are to blame for the power outages. The cold and ice last night drove many to seek out warming shelters. It also halted MAX service and grounded many flights out of PDX. In Multnomah County, warming shelters were over capacity, but no one was turned away. Warming shelters are still open this evening at Reynolds High School, Portsmouth Union, Arbor Lodge, Sunrise Center, and the Oregon Convention Center. Multnomah County is seeking volunteers to help support at the warming shelters this evening, with an online orientation available. In Washington County, residents can look to the Salvation Army building in Hillsboro in the Beaverton Community Center. In Clackamas County, Father's Heart Street Ministry in Oregon City, the Malala Hope Center, and Zohar Lutheran Church in Canby will be open to folks needing warmth this evening. Across the metro area, residents can call 211 for more information on emergency resources or to request a ride. TriMet is free to anyone headed to a warming shelter. If residents see someone suffering from the cold, they can call the non-emergency helpline to request a welfare check at 503-823-3333. Clinton Rocky is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Portland. Rocky told the Oregonian, quote, "Mother Nature gave everybody a day to sit back and enjoy an extra cup of coffee or cocoa," end quote. He called Friday, quote, "Respect Nature Day," end quote. 60% of Americans, or more than 200 million people, were under a winter weather advisory or warning today. Forecasters have called this, quote, "one of the greatest extents of winter weather warnings and advisories ever," end quote. Experts said a bomb cyclone, when atmospheric pressure drops very quickly in a strong storm, developed near the Great Lakes, stirring up heavy winds and snow. Adverse conditions, including record low temperatures, blizzards, and power outages, led to a host of canceled holiday gatherings and travel, as well as classes. More than 3,400 flights within, into, or out of the U.S. were canceled today. Regional airports, including PDX and SeaTac, canceled multiple flights and or closed runways. And in Canada, WestJet canceled all flights at Toronto Pearson International. Also, more than 458,000 homes and businesses were without power this morning. Activists have been mobilizing to help the houseless. In Chicago, the nonprofit Feeding People Through Plants was offering tents, propane heaters, and other supplies. The tents are modeled on ice fishing tents, including a plywood subfloor. Congress has passed a $1.7 trillion budget deal, which now heads to President Biden's desk. With more on the story, we have Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The omnibus was a appropriate metaphor for the last 2 years. A lot of Sturm und Drang, a lot of ups and downs, but at the end, a great result that really helped the American people.
The Senate passed a $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill to keep the federal government funded until next September. Congress has approved several continuing resolutions to avoid a government shutdown. The House could consider the measure today. Members of Congress have said the alternative to passing a full-fledged budget would be to pass a one-year continuing resolution that could leave numerous government agencies improperly funded. During a news conference about providing support to Ukraine in its war against Russia, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about Afghanistan's decision to ban women from attending universities.
What they've done is to try to sentence Afghan women and girls to a dark future without opportunity. And the bottom line is that no country is going to be able to succeed, much less thrive, if it denies half its population the opportunity to contribute.
He said there will be costs if this decision is not changed. Blinken noted if the Taliban seeks to improve relations between Afghanistan and the U.S., policies like this are a step in the wrong direction. Now that the Supreme Court has delayed lifting Title 42, which allows authorities to expel migrants from U.S. land borders for public health reasons, some question the nature of this delay. But David Beer, Associate Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, feels the implementation of Title 42 has less to do with public health and more to do with Republican states' stance on immigration.
It's really not a question of public health, and that should be what this law is about. It's supposedly about the public health necessity, which from the very beginning has always been a farce. There is never any public health rationale.
In his farewell address as House Majority Leader, Representative Stanley Hoyer described his approach to work in Congress and the need for agreement among congressional Democrats.
I approach my work and leadership with one principle in mind, the psychology of consensus. What is this psychology of consensus? It means having a greater sense of us being in this work together.
The state of Arizona is removing its makeshift border wall of shipping containers. The wall was put up in August by executive order from Governor Doug Ducey, but without official permits or authorization. Since the makeshift wall was erected, the federal government has been battling the state to have the containers removed. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Environmental Protection Agency has ordered the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to stop discharging oil and other pollutants into the Columbia River from four dams in Washington and Oregon. The environmental group Columbia Riverkeeper says these toxic chemicals harm fish and other wildlife in the Columbia and Snake Rivers and sued the Corps last year to force the discharges to stop. Mike Moran has more on the recent spills and the EPA's actions to confront them.
The EPA has ordered the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to stop oil and other toxic chemical discharges into the Columbia River in Washington and Oregon. Recent spills have the issue back at the forefront. The group Columbia Riverkeeper sued the Corps last year and says these pollutants harm fish and other wildlife in the Columbia and Snake Rivers. Miles Johnson, the group's senior attorney, says the permits address four dams along the river that are pollution sources, and the problem is bigger than petroleum and chemical pollution.
In addition, the dams create big reservoirs that soak up the sun's energy and make the river too hot for salmon and steelhead. The permits that EPA issued to the Army Corps are a directive to deal with some of those problems.
In operating the dams, the Corps will be required to use environmentally friendly lubricants, pay closer attention to water temperatures in those reservoirs, and remove water from some of them if they get too hot for the fish to survive. The issue was highlighted again recently when between 300 and 600 gallons of oil leaked into the Snake River from a turbine at Little Goose Dam in eastern Washington. Johnson says this type of pollution has become a pattern with the Corps and has to be monitored and addressed constantly.
Sometimes it's 1 gallon, sometimes it's 5 gallons, sometimes it's hundreds of gallons or even thousands of gallons. And sometimes that oil contains toxic chemicals like PCBs. And after watching it happen over and over again, Columbia Riverkeeper took action, which is what we do when someone illegally discharges pollution into the river.
The EPA took the action under the Clean Water Act. Columbia Riverkeeper has sued federal and state agencies multiple times and continues to monitor Northwest waterways and the wildlife that depend on them. For Washington News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
Students on college campuses are tackling the common issue of hunger. At Central Washington University, students also are thinking of other ways they can help their peers. Eric Tegetoff has the details.
Hunger is pervasive on college campuses across the country, including in Washington. A university in the state is one example of how students are trying to tackle food insecurity at its roots. Central Washington University's Wildcat Pantry provides food and essentials to students, faculty, and staff. Pantry coordinator Jada Nelson says they're working on implementing another program to help students in the winter quarter.
Peer student ambassadors that can support students in their enrollment for SNAP, to get their utilities bills reduced, to get their Wi-Fi reduced, all those sorts of things so that they can get support in those finances as well.
Nelson says she also supports the food recovery program, which packages food that normally goes to waste so that it can be distributed to pantries. It's estimated about a third of students nationally face food insecurity. Nelson says the rising cost of goods means the gap that even students with financial aid need to fill is getting larger. She says insecurity around other basic needs also is high, such as for affordable housing and child care.
All of these experiences are so interrelated that it really limits students' ability to learn, to be successful, to actually have the ability to continue on in academics, which is why retention continues to be low, and a lot of colleges are experiencing that.
Nelson says many of the pantries on other college campuses that she's researched and witnessed operate like the Wildcat Pantry.
So much of it is student-driven, and I think it's a good thing because it allows these programs to be peer-to-peer and to reduce the stigma associated with people's level of worthiness.
Nelson says another way to help students is for Washington state lawmakers to pass the Hunger Free Campus Bill, which sends funding to public colleges that are addressing student hunger on campus. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Students headed for universities in the new year will be facing new challenges and choices. Economic conditions are forcing many rural universities to consolidate or eliminate entire programs. Mike Moran has more on the phenomenon in Iowa.
Students choosing a college next semester are faced with new challenges and difficult choices. The current economic climate is forcing many higher education institutions to cut or consolidate programs. The problem is especially acute at rural universities, already facing stiffer recruitment challenges than larger urban schools, and still having to meet their financial goals. Andrew Korisich, who heads the Alliance for Research on Regional Colleges, says students who were planning to attend a rural college may have to shift their focus or may opt not to attend college at all.
What happens to rural students in rural communities when the colleges that they rely on are not left whole? That we're cutting down on what their choices are. We may be saying you can only take classes online for these programs. And so it really is a restriction of choice, much beyond what folks in cities and suburbs have to face.
The University of Iowa is considering reorganizing its liberal arts college, which currently has 39 departments, and Iowa State University, facing a budget deficit that tops $11 million, is looking at trimming or eliminating programs that aren't in high demand. Administrators say they're under financial pressure to offer the courses that students demand most. Korisich says the problem is more pressing at rural schools, but a decade-long nationwide drop in college enrollment could mean the consolidation won't stop there.
Even your large flagship land-grant universities are not immune to this. States are figuring out how to allocate funds to all of the things they allocate towards. There's a big accountability push. Some of those tensions are what's actually happening with Iowa State.
Other larger universities have announced plans to consolidate as well, and many are facing budget shortfalls. For Iowa News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. Then at 7, it's Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be foggy, with a mix of rain and snow and a low of 37 degrees. A winter storm warning is in effect until 10 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy, with a high of 46. Today in history, in 1815, Jane Austen's Emma is published. The quote of the day is from American writer and new journalism pioneer Joan Didion, who died this day in 2021. Didion said, "You have to pick the places you don't walk away from." Recent Arizona State University graduate has big plans for the future. Tylesha Yellowhair wants to help shape public policy in Arizona that guides social services for tribal members. This means not only helping to provide solutions to systemic issues, but also changing what she sees as the public's general perception of Native communities. Alex Gonzalez has more.
Arizona tribal communities face inequalities every day. One recent Arizona State University graduate says she wants to shape public policy to help change that. Tylesha Yellowhair says changing public policy that guides social services would not only ensure that tribal members receive the care they need, but also help to change the public perception of Native communities. She says tribal communities face challenges like any other, but they hold lots of strength and resiliency. Yellowhair is from the Navajo Nation, originally from Kayenta, Arizona, and currently works in the Office of Health Programs for the Phoenix Area Indian Health Services as a social service assistant. She says she wants her story to serve as an inspiration to others.
I hope that my story being shared can change the image of what people have of Native communities. Like, we too can become professionals. We too can deal with policy. We too have the power to change what's happening around us.
Yellowhair comes from a family of teachers and is the first social worker and public administrator. She says her mother, a teacher of more than 50 years, was fundamental in helping her understand that people have different lived experiences. Yellowhair says her childhood influenced the work she does today. She acknowledges that she grew up in a home with two educated working parents and knows that wasn't the case for everyone. Her graduate work led her to study violence in indigenous communities, specifically against Native women and children. Yellowhair says she hasn't met a single Native woman who wasn't impacted by some sort of violence in her life, and she's convinced there must be a greater focus on this issue.
To me, that speaks volumes, and that is what continues to drive me as a person who strives to be an advocate for my community.
Yellowhair says she has the tools to fight for justice and reparations. She says she hopes to give back to her community and others by advocating through policy or fighting for systemic change. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Congress has increased funding for the National Labor Relations Board in its upcoming budget. While the budget process has been at a stalemate, concerns abound over whether the agency could remain effective without this funding. Edwin J. Vieira reports.
Congress has approved a funding boost of $25 million for the National Labor Relations Board. Labor experts hope this will allow the agency to better handle a swath of petitions from people who want to unionize their workplaces. According to the NLRB, over 2,500 union petitions have been filed between September 2021 and October 2022, the most the agency has seen since 2016. But since 2014, the NLRB has seen a 25% decline in funding. Erin Mahoney with the Communications Workers of America describes what a better funded NLRB would be capable of.
A well-funded National Labor Relations Board would mean that we would go back to having on-time elections and not waiting weeks for those to be determined, sometimes months. We'd be able to see decisions made more quickly when employers put forward frivolous appeals and things like that.
Though the agency received $25 million, several members of Congress signed on to a letter saying the agency should receive a $368 million funding boost. Mahoney notes that if a hike had not been approved, it would have further delayed ongoing union organizing efforts across the country. The agency was preparing for dire consequences if the funding didn't come through. In November, the chairwoman and general counsel of the NLRB sent a letter to members of a U.S. House subcommittee urging them to approve a budget increase. Sarah Steffens, also with the Communications Workers of America, describes what a lack of funding would have meant for workers' rights.
Really, there is only one place, the National Labor Relations Board, that protects workers in these situations. So if they are underfunded, it's like tying the government's hand behind its back when it comes to enforcing labor laws.
The NLRB has already implemented a hiring freeze to weather the effects from low funding. The letter adds the NLRB expects to use the additional budget amount for a pay increase in January and to cover non-labor-related inflation costs. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
The Alaska Department of Corrections has announced its 18th in-custody death this year, the most in two decades. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska Department of Corrections disclosed another inmate death this week, the 18th to die in state custody, the highest death rate in two decades.
I'd like to know why they died or how they died.
State Senator Donnie Olson would like to know more about the Alaska Native inmates who died. Of the 18, 9 were either Alaska Native or American Indian, and 8 were from Olson's district, which takes in a huge swath of the northernmost parts of the state.
As a physician, I value life very highly, and to have deaths happen with this number, especially when there's so many of them are from my district, I am very disturbed by it.
Senator Olson says he supports demands from the Alaska Civil Liberties Union for a full-scale investigation into this year's prison deaths, one they say the governor of Alaska has ignored. His administration has said none of the deaths were suspicious or unusual. But Olson says with half of them from one minority group, that should be a huge red flag. Megan Edge, who heads up the ACLU's prison project, says these deaths point to a systemic problem in Alaska's prisons.
It's not surprising in that regard. And I don't mean that to like undermine it. It's incredibly sad. But I think it goes to show that we're still running a system that disregards the lives of Black and brown people.
Edge says the high rates of suicide, especially for Alaska Native inmates, are also cause for alarm. The Department of Corrections said in a statement that its staff takes every death very seriously, regardless of race or nationality, and that updated policy and procedures meet the ever-changing national standards set by the National Commission on Correctional Health Care. Families of the inmates who died in custody have told the ACLU they've had trouble getting information from the state about how their loved one died. The Corrections Department says it can't give out those details, citing medical privacy laws. Senator Olson has told families to contact his office if they need help in learning more. An Arizona State University graduate says she wants to help shape public policy to help change inequities Native Americans face. Alex Gonzalez has more.
Tylisha Yellowhair says changing public policy that guides social services would not only ensure that tribal members receive the care they need, but also help to change the public perception of Native communities. She says tribal communities face challenges like any other, but they hold lots of strength and resiliency. Yellowhair is from the Navajo Nation and currently works in the Office of Health Programs for the Phoenix Area Indian Health Services as a social service assistant. She says she wants her story to serve as an inspiration to others.
I hope that my story being shared can change the image of what people have of Native communities. Like, we too can become professionals. We too can deal with policy. We too have the power to change what's happening around us.
Yellowhair comes from a family of teachers and is the first social worker and public administrator. She says her mother, a teacher of more than 50 years, was fundamental in helping her understand that people have different lived experiences. Yellowhair says her childhood influenced the work she does today. She acknowledges that she grew up in a home with two educated working parents and knows that wasn't the case for everyone. Her graduate work led her to study violence in Indigenous communities, specifically against Native women and children. Yellowhair says she hasn't met a single Native woman who wasn't impacted by some sort of violence in her life, and she's convinced there must be a greater focus on this issue.
To me, that speaks volumes, and that is what continues to drive me as a person who strives to be an advocate for my community.
She says she hopes to give back to her community and others by advocating through policy or fighting for systemic change.
That was Alex Gonzalez, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Shifts in tuna populations could cost Pacific Islands more than $90 million a year. Warming waters are expected to push the tuna out of the island's jurisdiction. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Tuvalu, Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, and other small Pacific Island nations, the tuna fishing industry is a linchpin of the economy.
It is very significant, mainly in revenue for the countries.
Sangalofa Clark is CEO of the Parties to the Nauru Agreement Office. The organization was created by an agreement among small Pacific Islands to collaboratively manage the region's tuna fishery. Fishing vessel owners from around the world pay access fees to fish in these nations' waters. And in several of the countries, that money provides more than 40% of government revenue each year. But as oceans warm, tuna populations are expected to shift east and north into waters beyond these nations' jurisdiction. Clark was part of a team that estimated the potential losses in fishing fees revenue for 10 small island economies if carbon pollution keeps increasing through 2050.
The changes are projected to cause a loss in government revenue of around $90 million a year.
So although these countries generate only a tiny amount of carbon pollution, they will pay a steep price for the warming caused by others. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 23rd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Mark Moran, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, so now is a great time to get involved. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the House Committee on the January 6th, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol heard more than 1,000 witness interviews and held multiple public hearings, resulting in criminal referrals to the Justice Department for Donald Trump, lawyer John Eastman, and others involved in violent efforts to override the results of Trump's election loss. The committee released transcripts showing some 24 witnesses invoking their right against self-incrimination. Eastman, key advisor to Trump on how to overturn the election, cited his Fifth Amendment right 155 times. At one point, Democratic House member Jamie Raskin asked GOP operative Roger Stone if he believed coups are allowed in our constitutional system, to which Stone said, quote, "I most definitely decline to respond to your question," close quote. But the headwinds that the committee's recommendations face are not just from the MAGA hatters, but also some of the very smart people who will tell us that our desire for justice is really just partisan, or worse, bloodlust. And what we really ought to do, what intelligent people would do, is, well, nothing. Let wiser minds prevail. We're having none of that. We spoke with Lisa Gilbert. She's executive vice president.